Have you or a loved one ever watched American daytime television? Then you may be entitled to this episode. I'm Kyle Plouffe with the Law Offices of Detto & Detto. And today, we bring you two classic stories of daytime television turning deadly.
Ask him, he's been married for how long? Oh, over 20 years.
Look at him though, he look mad.
We're good friends.
Well, guess what? It's Scott that has the crush on you.
You lied to me.
If you or a loved one have ever been the victim of trash TV, call 1-800-DETTO and tune in today on Death in Entertainment.
Live from Los Angeles.
911, what is your emergency?
Here in Hollywood now.
Two counts of murder,
injury, and death.
Oh my God!
Shocking new details
that has stunned the entertainment world.
This makes me a little nervous.
The hair stood up on my arms.
Just like in the movies.
What do you call this thing anyway?
Death in entertainment.
Hello, Detto Universe.
Hi.
Greetings from Dipod Studios.
It's great to be here.
My name is Kyle Plouffe.
And I'm Alejandro Dowling.
And today we are talking about the deaths of daytime TV.
Oh boy, this is a big one.
This is a big one. It's something we've talked about for quite a while. We are doing two stories. One's a little aperitif. And then the second one is all about Jenny Jones and the infamous death of Scott Amador.
That all sounds so great, Kyle, but can we rewind a little?
Yes.
Aperitif.
An aperitif, yes.
What the hell is that?
It's an alcoholic...
It's an Alka-Seltzer.
It's an Alka-Seltzer. Come on. It's an alcoholic drink taken before a meal to stimulate the appetite.
Oh, okay? I like it.
It's an appetizing wine.
Yes.
The appetizer of wines. The aperitif.
Okay, so it's a nice story for the nice people.
Yeah, not quite. It is a story of tragedy and death that will... get everybody going.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Quick reminder that we are a true crime and entertainment comedy podcast.
Yes.
So if you're easily offended, please don't put yourself through this ordeal. Go somewhere else.
Pack up a bag and take a flight.
Oh, boy. I was trying to be nice.
All right. Get out of here because we're going to have some giggles and have a couple laughs talking about some very dark things. So if that ain't your bag, baby, get out while you can. And now. Here are the stories.
Kyle, woo, woo,
woo, woo. I like that. When we have a live show, maybe that'll be a thing someday. We are, of course, referring to Jerry, who is one of the, you know,
Titans of trash TV.
Of smut TV, yeah. And this episode, I mean, this story, number one, isn't necessarily smut TV. It was thrown in with all the daytime shows, and it might have been actually a little break from the smut TV.
Hmm.
And this story revolves around Mr. Renard Spivey.
Okay.
This man was born on July 20th, 1956, deep in the heart of Texas.
So he's a Texan.
Yes, which coincidentally is where all my exes live. All my exes live in Texas.
Oh, right. Beer That's for my horses. Yeah.
Why I settled down in Tennessee.
Save a horse, ride a cowboy. Yeah.
New York City. It appears he became a Harris County detention officer in Houston. In 1996.
Okay.
So
that actually is the same year as Jenny Jones, isn't it?
Ooh, a lot of things going on.
What was
mid to late 90s here?
What was happening in 96? We had Independence Day.
Yeah. A lot going on.
We had, okay, that's it. Twister.
Ha ha. 2 years later, in 1998, he became a Harris County Sheriff's Deputy, where he worked until entering the entertainment industry in the early 2000s.
So that's quite a pivot to go from being a deputy to being on TV.
Yeah, and reports before then said that he was a drill sergeant in the Marine Corps previous to all this, because he was born in 56, so in 96 he was 40 years old. He had quite a life in the military and then in law enforcement.
Yeah.
So he had a lot going on, and he was a giant of a man, just absolutely jacked out of his head. He could have been in the WWE. Like, he just had that physical steroided out shape.
So that's also why he works so well on television.
Mm-hmm.
The visual of him in that courtroom. I assume it's a courtroom show we're getting to.
That was my question. If people are asking at home, where did he end up going in the entertainment industry? Well, let us tell you right here. He became the bailiff on Christina's court with Christina Perez.
I'm jealous. I would kill to be a bailiff on one of those court TV shows, like Bird on Judge Judy.
Oh, yeah.
Can you think of a more cushy gig than that?
No, it's ridiculous.
You just show up, you stand there, she cracks a couple jokes to you.
Yeah.
And then you grab some papers once in a while.
And that's literally it. It's unbelievable. Okay, so if you forget Christina's Court and the gigantic shuffle of judge shows from the late 90s and early 2000s, who could blame you? Because there wasn't really much setting them apart.
I do not remember Christina's Court.
Yeah.
I remember the People's Court.
Yeah, because let's go through some of the lists here. We got Judge Judy, giant.
She's the number one, right?
Well, People's Court was the original number one. And then Judge Judy just came over and took the scene by storm.
And that was her husband on the People's Court.
Yes, the original. Yeah, Judge Shineland.
Yep.
Is the husband of Judy Shineland. Shineland.
Shineland, yeah.
Yeah. Judge Joe Brown.
I remember him.
Judge Mills Lane.
Wow, that is bringing back memories.
Judge Mathis.
Oh, yeah.
Judge Hatchett.
Yeah.
Judge Alex. Judge Maria Lopez.
Okay, now you're just making names up.
Judge Jeanine Pirro.
Oh, she's the Fox News lunatic.
Yep. Judge Karen. I mean, there's a lot going on. There's a lot of judges. And then Christina's Court was one of these.
All right.
So there's really nothing setting them apart. They're all doing the same thing. It's essentially small claims court.
Those shows make a lot of money.
Yeah.
And they're cheap to produce. They're even cheaper to produce than talk shows.
Oh, yeah.
And Judge Judy had a whole operation where it's paid background actors in the audience.
Yep.
She probably films 3 or 4 episodes a day.
Yeah, the same company that I used to work for to go see the Steve Wilkos show would staff the Judge Judy, People's Court, sorry, because People's Court was in New York.
And you got to see Jerry Springer and Steve Wilkos, correct?
Yeah.
Yep. That's awesome.
This time was truly a gold rush for judges who wanted to cash out of the legal system and go straight into entertainment. It was just free money. You were dumb if you didn't do it. There were so many of them. And Christina's Court was filmed at KRIV, which is the local Fox affiliate in Houston, Texas. So the entertainment industry came to Renard's backyard.
Did you hear that?
Renard's backyard.
This thing on, folks.
Which must be nice, because it's like, okay, you're making a certain amount, kind of capped in law enforcement. And then all of a sudden, this TV show comes and you get to be the bailiff.
Mm-hmm.
So
there's no better gig.
Yeah. He just starts making more money instantly. The show came and went. It got 3 consecutive daytime Emmy Awards, which was a record until Judge Judy caught up to Christina in 2017 with that record. Other than that, the show was pretty inconsequential.
Daytime Emmy for what, though? Best court show?
Yeah.
And Judge Judy won it how many times?
Well, Judge Judy was a night show first. That's why she didn't have that daytime Emmy Award.
It was considered a night show?
It would go on at night.
Really?
Yeah.
I thought it was like 3 p.m.
The reruns would go on at 3.
Oh, wow. So it was in that Wheel of Fortune type bracket.
Yeah.
Jeopardy.
She started airing in primetime, Judge Judy.
I did not know that.
Yeah. And then the later seasons were rerun and syndication.
Okay.
Yeah, because I remember her being on at night. It was that Wheel of Fortune, Jeopardy, you know, time. I think she would come on at 8 because Wheel of Fortune and Jeopardy would be 7, 7:30, and then boom, go right into Judge Judy.
What a block.
Yeah, it's incredible.
Your Nana must have been beside herself.
I was in heaven.
Yeah.
Because I was watching TV with her.
Or what about Auntie Jill? Was she a Judge Judy head?
I don't think she was more daytime soap operas.
Ah.
She was a bus driver.
Oh, so she wouldn't have seen Judge Judy in the nighttime.
She was snoozing by then. Yeah, she was out. And then she'd wake up and, you know, watch her reruns of, or her taped versions of General Hospital and all that stuff. Then go work. And then, you know, she'd have time off in between the AM shift and PM shift and catch up with all the soaps.
Yeah, you can't watch 2 soaps at a time.
No. You gotta take your time with it. So, like I said, the show, pretty inconsequential. Not many memorable things happened. It wasn't until recently that this show really went viral. I believe it was exactly a year ago when this clip went on to TikTok and YouTube and just blew up. Because in one of the seasons, comedian Sean Harris showed up on set, who is actually related to the late, great comedian Robin Harris.
Oh, wow. Bebe's kids.
He played the bartender in I'm Gonna Get You, Sucka. And then he also had roles in Do the Right Thing and Harlem Nights. He played the father of Kid in House Party in 1990, for which he got a posthumous Independent Spirit Award. And he followed up later that year as a jazz club MC in Mo Betta Blues. And creator of one of my favorite cartoons as a child, like you said, Bebe's Kids.
That could actually be an episode because he did not live to see any of that success.
Robin passed away while Bebe's Kids was in pre-production.
So crazy.
On March 18th, 1990, Harris died at the age of 36 from cardiac arrhythmia.
Oh my God, I'm older than him.
Yep. At the Chicago's Four Seasons Hotel. He collapsed in his hotel suite where he was staying while he performed at the Regal Theater. His brother found him unresponsive. Harris was transported back to California and interred at an indoor mausoleum at Inglewood Park Cemetery near Los Angeles.
Yeah, that is fascinating when someone doesn't get to see. I don't think he got to see House Party.
He didn't even get to see his son being born. Robin Harris Jr. was born 6 months after his death in September 1990.
Oh my God.
Yeah. The second episode of In Living Color aired a month after his death and was dedicated to his memory. So, I mean, there's a lot going on there.
There is. Yeah. There is.
And it's so funny because Sean looks just like him and he just shows up on Christina's court.
Yeah.
And he is so goddamn funny. He's having the judge crack up, the bailiff crack up. He even has his ex-wife cracking up with the person he's suing. The whole crowd's going crazy.
So it's very performative. It's a gig for him, probably.
They even show his stand-up on the show.
Yeah.
They're like, how funny are you? And he's like, ah, pretty funny. And then they show a clip of him on stage.
Oh, my God.
So, yeah, he brought his ex-girlfriend to court over 9 months of unpaid rent totaling $4,500. Mm. His ex said that she paid in ways that were priceless. You can't put a price tag on love, okay?
No.
But you can on rent. Essentially, her...
Very true.
Essentially, her argument was that she paid in taking care of his child and his sexual needs.
Oh boy, let's not get too personal.
Mm-hmm. He ends up winning the $4,500 that he asked for. All's well that ends well.
Yeah.
But what happened during the episode would foreshadow a murder charge.
Ooh. I want my money. That ain't no joke.
How many?
I don't have it.
Nice.
How many times did you ask him for the money?
How could it be true love when I'm getting yelled at constantly like a child in my
own house?
People
in love, they yell at each other all the time.
Oh, that's true. Ask him, he's been married for how long?
Over 20-something years.
Over 20-something.
Look at him, though. He look mad. You don't look happy, brother. You don't look happy.
You can tell. This is what he's been doing the whole time, is just crushing.
Yeah.
But he goes, you don't look happy, brother. And the guy doesn't. He's just huge, just has his arms folded and just kind of has that look like he's not going to take anybody's shit. But him saying that made him laugh. But for the whole time, he just kind of like mean mugging. Just nobody thought anything about that episode until 4 years ago.
Harris County Sheriff's deputy is facing serious charges at this hour, charged with murder in the death of his wife. Good morning and thank you for joining us. I'm Andy Sirota.
Yeah, so he ends up killing his wife.
So he was not having a good time in his marriage.
Yeah, she's like, oh, trust him. He's been married for how many years? 20-something years. Oh, he knows how marriage is. Cut to, you don't look happy, brother. Then cut to, this man is arrested for killing his wife.
Oh, my God. women.
Yeah.
You can't kill him.
Oh, my God. Let's listen to hear what happened.
Christine Noel, the shooting happened over the weekend at the couple's home. New documents have been released in this case. Channel 2's Kathy Hernandez joins us live with what we're learning about what exactly happened inside that home. Kathy, the victim's family spoke with you today.
That's right. Renard Spivey remains here behind bars at the Harris County Jail. Documents released just in the last hour say that he and his wife were fighting over a gun when he accidentally shot her.
What?
I guess the best word to say would be encouraged.
Ezra Washington visits Law Park in Southeast Houston daily, but the last couple of days, it's with a heavy heart. His sister, Patricia Spivey, was murdered. Her husband, also a Harris County Sheriff's Deputy, Renard Spivey, is now charged in her death.
Justice will be done.
I have to say, watching that original clip when they were talking about his marriage and he didn't look happy, my Spivey senses were going off.
Nice. Renard Spivey senses went off. So this is the brother of his wife, Patricia, who was killed. And he's saying justice will be done. He said, you know, pretty much he knew that the couple was fighting like cats and dogs. They could not stop. They were arguing like crazy. Even Renard said himself that he admitted they had been fighting all day leading up to this thing.
And then they're fighting over a gun?
They're fighting over lack of intimacy. Then they're both cheating on each other. They're both calling each other out for cheating. He stated that she took out a gun and then they were fighting over it. He got shot in the leg by her. And then after that, he ripped the gun out of her hands. And as he was ripping the gun out of her hands, it turned to her and she got shot twice. And so she was found dead in the master bedroom closet. Yeah, three shots are fired. One's into his thigh and one's into her chest and one's into her leg, I believe.
So he got shot too.
Yeah. And so she's dead on arrival. He called 911 immediately and said that he accidentally shot his wife. He was also shot and they just did not believe him at all. Her family members came out and said that they believe he's on steroids and he had roid rage and he killed her because he knew that the marriage wasn't going to work out.
And they're not young bucks anymore.
Yeah.
They're acting ridiculous.
Yeah, this is absolutely ridiculous for people in their 50s and 60s to be doing.
They did not get wiser with age.
No. So Renard Spivey was arrested in the Harris County Jail where he previously worked as a detention officer.
Oh, man.
Going back to work on the other side of the time slip. July 29th, 2019. Prosecutors wanted a bail of $100,000 because they thought he was going to go on the run, but he was released on a $50,000 bond.
That's not very much for murder.
No. He admitted that before the shooting, he and his wife, Patricia, were tussling with a gun. Just tussling. And authorities found Patricia Spivey dead in the closet of the couple's bedroom.
So do you think he shot himself in the thigh? Afterwards?
That is quite the proposal, you say there.
Because if he was trying to cover it up, why would he call the cops and admit to it so fast and not try to get away with it? He could have said she just went on a long vacation.
Yeah. Well, there was blood everywhere. When the police went in there, you can't really hide that.
You could say it was red wine. It worked for Ashton Kutcher.
I guess. But he was a little bit more famous, more powerful than a Court TV bailiff.
In your opinion.
IMO, yeah. IMHO. They found three bullet casings along with a 9mm semi-automatic handgun. The couple had been arguing all day. Three shots fired as they tussled. One of them went through Renard's left thigh while the other two struck Patricia's right arm and chest.
What a wholesome way to go.
The first bullet went through her arm and into her chest, which broke her arm.
Fighting all day long, and yeah. Then it ends with this tussle.
Stupid, yeah.
And a gunshot, multiple gunshots that end in the death.
Senseless.
Yeah. What a waste of time.
Yeah. The second bullet went through her heart and lungs. So that was the shot. She could have survived the first one.
Just go live with someone else.
Yeah, just to end it.
There's so many couples that just fight, fight, fight.
And I've been in those couples, and it's draining. It's like when you get older, you realize nobody's worth that amount of stress.
You can go hang out with somebody else.
Yeah, exactly.
You know?
Plenty of fish in the sea.
There are. There's plenty of other cattle out there in Texas.
That's right. More cows to tip. According to the Houston Chronicle, the Harris County District Attorney's Office said that the court had an opportunity to hold Spivey guilty of a lesser charge of manslaughter, which is super important in a case like this because it casts such a wide net, and they're just trying to catch him on something. If you're not going to get him for murder, then get him for manslaughter. Come on, do the right thing.
Murder is hard because he was shot too, unless they can prove that he shot himself.
Exactly. Can you prove that?
I don't know. Maybe the ballistics expert could
the angle at which it went through him, but then it's like you're fighting and who knows.
What would Dexter say?
He would say...
He'd probably kill him later.
Yeah. So they have the whole trial. Patricia's brother said at the time, I should have acted on, you know, the knowledge that they were fighting all the time and gotten her out of there. Because that way she would have survived and they would have been broken up. And you know what? It would have saved a lot of headaches and someone's life.
Not everybody listens, though.
Nope.
It's not up to the brother.
Yeah. There were 12 hours of deliberation on the last day of the trial. What say you?
I think he was guilty of manslaughter.
Oh, so you wouldn't go murder one?
No.
But you probably would have been asking the question, did he shoot himself in the thigh?
Right.
And if you think he shot himself in the thigh, then he definitely killed her on purpose.
Right.
After 12 hours of deliberation, which is, generally speaking, a small amount of time, especially for a murder case.
Yeah, it really isn't that long, because sometimes it can go on for weeks.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. He was acquitted of all charges.
No!
Yeah. So that's the reason I wanted to cover this, because you see these stories and you just assume, like, oh, that guy's gone forever. He's so fucked. Especially with that clip where the dude's just saying, you don't look happy, brother. Then his wife ends up getting shot to death.
Acquitted of all charges?
Not even manslaughter. The jury found the shooting to be accidental.
Oh, wow.
Spivey's defense team believes the jury doubted the state's theory that he killed his wife because his marriage was falling apart. Quote, I don't believe either Mr. or Mrs. Spivey intended to let that gun fire. I think each discharge was accidental.
Uh-huh.
Mm.
And if you believe that, I got a piece of the Golden Gate Bridge for you.
So Mr. Spivey is free to live his life in Houston, Texas to this day.
Living every husband's dream.
Yeah, he was actually acquitted just a few months ago in December.
Really?
So, yeah, and it was like all these stories, they get reported on first, and then they just allow your imagination to take over and be like, oh, that person's fucked forever. He's definitely going to prison, and that's why they're not covering it. There was very little news coverage of him being acquitted of all charges.
That's insane, yeah. Honestly.
Yeah.
Not even manslaughter.
Nope. Manslaughter.
Not even
no
woman,
slaughter.
Woman slaughter.
Zero slaughter.
So that was brilliant to get shot in the thigh.
Well, if it was a calculated move, I guess it worked out in his favor.
Because who needs your thigh? It's a safe thing to.
Well, there's one story.
From.
No, there's one story that we will cover. There was a professional football player who
died using the thigh master.
Yes, exactly.
Suzanne Summers is a serial killer.
There was a home invasion, and he was shot in the leg to prevent him from attacking them as they made their exit, and it clipped his femoral artery and he bled out and died. And
femoral artery, again, that's like Don LaPree last week.
Yep, exactly.
Who tried to kill himself with that way.
Yeah.
But then succeeded later on with the throat.
Yes.
I have to say, though, that story you just said about the guy dying when the intruder shot him, that is the scariest thought to me, to be at home and then a group of people invade your space.
Just to completely break in.
God, is that frightening. That's like Charles Manson level horror.
Yeah. Yeah, the NFL player that was killed was Sean Taylor. He was a safety for the Washington Redskins when they were known as the Redskins.
Yeah, that's just...
Murdered in 2007 via femoral artery.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Okay, well, I take it back then.
Yeah.
I guess Renard Spivey could have been killed being shot in the thigh.
Mm.
So I guess he did not do it to himself. Mm. You convinced me, Kyle.
He's got pretty thick thighs, though.
Okay.
Thick thighs save lives, as they say. So RIP to Patricia Spivey.
Yes. Very sad.
Terrible way to go. And
sorry you had such a miserable relationship. And
last day.
You had to die for it.
Yeah. Brutal.
Ugh.
Story number two takes us to the Midwest from the South.
It's more my speed, more my area.
Yes. It's all, you know, up around Chicago and Michigan. But to start the story, we start in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Scott Amador was born January 26, 1963, in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hammer down, as Pat McAfee would say. He was the baby in a six-sibling family. And although he was born in Pittsburgh, the family made a home in Michigan in the northern suburbs of Clarkston and Lake Orion specifically.
Where's that near the bigger cities?
Detroit.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah.
Because I have a bunch of family in Michigan. Been there a bunch of times.
Yeah.
Never heard of this place.
Yep. It's reported that he dropped out of high school to join the Air Force, which I didn't know you could even do. Because I thought you had to have a diploma or a GED.
Huh. I'm glad I didn't get that offer because I would have dropped out of high school. Wait, I can drop out of high school? Cool. Where do I sign
up? And you'll give me a gun? But nevertheless, he joined the military and lasted with them for 4 years before returning to Michigan to pursue and take on life as an adult. He became a bartender at the Flamingo Club, which is a gay bar in Pontiac, Michigan.
I have been to Pontiac. Not that bar.
Oh, hey. No one's.
I know it sounded
no
like,
one's saying it's a bad thing.
I wish I, you know, could have. I mean, what was I saying? No. No, Pontiac, that is right near Detroit. Really strange area, though. Kind of run down, but with a nightlife.
Yeah.
And then there's a lot of places around Pontiac, like Bloomfield Hills, where it is obscenely rich.
Mm.
So it's a lot of...
So Pontiac is working class?
Yeah, not even. Like, the Silver Dome used to be there, but that's abandoned now. It just sits there.
Right.
It's really, like, not much of anything, except there's this weird strip of nightlife there where I guess this guy was working.
At the Flamingo Club.
Yes.
In Pontiac. It's not just a car. Michigan. That's their only slogan.
I just want the people to picture this place because it is so weird.
Right. When he moved back and became a bartender at the Flamingo Club, it was around 1985. So it might have been, you know, flourishing at this time.
Right.
Yeah. But it may not have been the best choice of work for him because he allegedly struggled mightily with substance abuse and had a lot of trouble maintaining relationships in life.
Mm.
There were reports that he was a victim of multiple domestic abusers.
Oh, no.
So, not a good thing.
No.
His friends remembered him as a self-admitted trash talk show junkie. Couldn't get enough of him and even told friends he would be on one day. So,
they're like, yeah?
You sure about that? So, back in these trying times of trash television, they used to have casting calls like before and after commercial breaks. They would be like, have you or a loved one ever experienced this or that?
Mm-hmm.
We want you on the Jenny Jones Show.
And they would be very specific.
Yeah.
Like, has your roommate slept with your uncle and then made a video making fun of you and then tried to sell it to your schoolmates?
And you want to peg them both on live TV? Come to the Jenny Jones Show.
Give us a call.
So,
have you ever been electrocuted while trying to attend the circus?
While your Uncle Danny does some bad things behind the urinals?
Do you have a dirty secret?
That's a pretty general one.
I was going to add to it, and I lost it.
So, she was another first run syndicated smut talk show that filmed out of Chicago.
Set the scene. What year are we in?
We are in 1995.
Oh, this is the height of trash TV.
That you can't get bigger.
Wow. Okay, so we got Sally Jesse Raphael.
Yes.
We have Maury Povich.
Jerry Springer.
And there was a bidding war at this time over this story of a woman who cut off her own breast implants.
Oh, my God.
And they were all like, come on our show. And Maury won.
Wow.
But that shows you what was selling at that time.
Oh, the culture was so fucked at this point.
So low.
Geraldo Rivera had his own show. Donahue. You know, this might have been when Donahue was kind of fading out.
Yeah, Donahue was the show.
Yeah.
That was before Oprah.
I was going to say, even Oprah. People don't remember. Oprah was a trash TV show before she started. You know, Bill Burr even has a bit about it. He's like, Oprah likes to think she's holier than thou. Do you know how many little people she stood on the shoulders of?
True.
And paraded out and made fun of until she got her, you know, big Tom Cruise moments and tried to become like a serious, almost journalist at that point.
Yeah. This is about the time when she started transitioning to the next phase of Oprah.
Yeah.
Where she was running marathons and, you know, capturing your spirit.
Yeah. We can't forget Ricky Lake at this time.
Ricky Lake. Yeah.
That's a big one. And yeah, I guess Jenny Jones would be the
Geraldo.
Yeah.
He was punched by a Nazi.
Yeah. Broke his nose.
Well, that was okay, but the Nazi stuff.
But all of those hosts, I think it's really
Morton Downey Jr.
Oh, that's another one. Yeah. All of those people accepted their label of trash TV, mm-hmm. except for Jenny Jones.
She didn't.
Jenny Jones resented it.
Wow.
The Jenny Jones Show premiered in September 1991 on 178 stations.
Wow.
So that's pretty good.
That's very good.
Yeah.
We're not on 178 stations.
It ran for 12 years until 2003 and was taped in Chicago at WMAQ-TV.
Ah.
Yeah, Chicago was the hotspot for trash TV at that time.
And Oprah filmed in Chicago for the entirety of her talk show run.
Mm.
And you want to know why?
Tax breaks?
No. It's because they all loved a Midwest audience.
Mm.
Because we react bigger.
Whoa!
Than, exactly. Like, oh, my God! You're not going to get that on the coast.
No.
In the Midwest, you get screaming, you get crying, you get jumping. And I'm not talking about Tom Cruise.
Yeah. This is a smut talk show that filmed out of Chicago, like we said. They had such classic episodes as, quote, "He's too close to his ex," and "You ruined my wedding." And, of course, who could forget "Tough Love," "Wild Teens in Lockdown."
Oh, boy. Years before the pandemic.
Yeah. So they were always, you know, "He's too close to his ex," "You ruined my wedding." They were always looking for that confrontation,
yes.
on the show.
Or some kind of big reveal, like having an affair, or
yeah.
"I'm a woman now."
Right. But that would lead to some sort of confrontation, and they'd be like, "Oh, let's get all this craziness on camera."
And they were innovative back then, because besides the fighting and all that, the people you would see on these talk shows, it was a slice of Americana that you didn't get anywhere else.
It was a slice of life, and we were living it.
Oh, boy. Come on. I'm onto something.
It's true. It's absolutely true, because you wouldn't see...
Like gay people.
Yeah.
Or trans. They say that's their first exposure that they got was Jerry Springer.
Absolutely. They would parade people out and say, they would have a contest saying, "Is this a man or a woman?"
Oh, fuck.
Do you remember those episodes?
I do.
And I'd be there with my dad voting at home as like a 12-year-old.
Jesus.
It's insane. I used to remember my dad being like, "Jesus Christ, that's a guy." But that's literally the introduction.
Yeah, people that's exactly. Yep.
The trans community. It was insane.
Yeah.
The particular casting call that Scott saw was looking for people who had a same-sex crush on someone that they wanted to reveal themselves to on national television. Enter Scott's friend, Jonathan Schmitz. So Scott hits them up and says, "I have this huge crush on one of my friends. He has no idea. I'd like to reveal myself to him on an episode." And they're like, fantastic. They get in touch with Jonathan, and the producers tell him that he has a secret crush who would like to tell him about themselves on the show. And Jonathan is a straight guy, so he automatically goes to, "Oh my God, this beautiful woman who's in love with me, I don't even know who it is. This is going to be incredible."
Did he never watch a talk show before? Come on.
He was young. He was.
How often are the secret crushes somebody hot that you want?
That's true too. Yeah.
It's never set up like that.
That's a good point. But I mean, this is the heyday of the show. It could have been early on. I mean, this is 95, so he probably had seen a couple episodes like that. But curiosity is going to get the cat. Is that the saying?
Yeah, curiosity killed the cat.
Curiosity is going to kill the cat, or maybe the cat kills somebody else.
Oh.
So he had said that the Jenny Jones producers didn't outright tell him it was a woman, but they alluded to the fact that it was a woman. So that's the reason why he signed up for it. He's like, "I'm very curious to see who this person in my life that I see all the time is." And
I'm definitely heterosexual.
Yes. So thinking he has this shot at this mystery woman, he accepts and is flown to Chicago for the taping.
Which could be very exciting.
Yeah.
Especially if they were flying from Pontiac.
Yeah.
Which apparently I'm not a big fan of.
Yeah.
I love Michigan, okay?
All right.
Don't get me wrong.
So here's footage from that fateful day.
Which of these ways would you choose to reveal your secret crush on someone? A, would you write that person a letter? B, would you tell the person in private in case he rejects you? Or C, would you tell that person that you're gay and you hope he is on national television?
Oh my God, and the audience is eating it up.
They're going crazy.
That Midwestern audience. They're evil.
Yeah, can't get it. No, he's gay.
You get a gay.
Yeah, it's like literally they're reacting crazier than when Oprah gave everybody a car. This is nuts.
Yeah. I have a question, though. This never aired, right?
Never saw the light of day. And we'll find out why.
Been helping Scott pursue his secret crush on John. John's backstage. He can't hear us.
Now, for the people just listening at home, Donna is a very strong-boned Midwestern woman, if you will.
Oh, my God. Don't you dare denigrate Midwesterners.
And then there's Scott, you know.
Boy next door kind of football.
He kind of looks like a magician. He's got a black vest on with a white button up, like he's going to do some card tricks. And he's got the sleeves rolled up. So he's like, you know, there's nothing up my sleeve except for my love of you.
He's not the quarterback, but he knows the quarterback.
He's the wide receiver.
How bad's the crush? Tell me about the first time you met him. Where was he?
He was under a car working on her brake line.
Yeah. And that was your first time? What was your first impression?
Well, I only saw the lower half of him, so you can imagine.
Oh. He was hot. So, yeah, he's discussing fantasies that he's had for this guy.
And before you are quick to judge, like, that he's being so over the top, he's coached by the producers to say all that.
That's exactly what they're looking for.
It's like a script he's following to make it entertaining.
Absolutely.
And he is entertaining, Scott.
He is.
You have fantasies about him?
I've had a couple, yeah.
Yeah, you had when he was under the car, you had a fantasy about him.
Yeah, something to do with like brake oil line snapping and, you know, when you just want to pick up and put in your hero cabinet, you know, dust him off once in a while.
You want to physically pick him up?
Oh, he's just a tiny little cute thing. He's gorgeous.
Well, all right, let's see if he really is. Get the headphones off of John, and let's have John come out here and see who has
it. I have another question. Do you think those were really soundproof headphones? Those shows always said that, so-and-so's backstage, and they can't hear us right now.
It was a common staple of these shows that they would put these giant headphones, much like the ones we have on right now, mm-hmm. and they said they were soundproof. I think they were playing music. I don't think they actually knew what was going on.
Okay.
But yeah, it was a common thing for people to, you know, reveal their secrets to the audience. And then the whole drama of it all was this person who had no idea what they were walking into, and everybody's in on the secret.
It's so disturbing when you look at it from that angle.
Yeah.
The audience just sitting there all in on it, part of this humiliation.
Oh, yeah. So they're all like grinning from ear to ear as they come out. And poor John, I mean, I feel for him in this situation because he comes out and he sees fucking Scott sitting there and Donna next to him like, what's going on here?
Right.
Who is the person that is going to come out? Because he's only got two choices at this point, and he has to be thinking it's Donna, like, thanks but no thanks.
Yeah.
And then
he'd rather go for Scott than Donna, let's be honest.
All right. So let's hear what happened.
Crush on him. Here's John.
So he tries to just shake Scott's hand, and then Scott pulls him in for a hug, and he's like kind of awkwardly half hugging him, like, and you know, just feels uncomfortable. You can sense something's wrong here.
Yeah.
Hi, John. Did you think Donna had the crush on you?
Did I? No, we're good friends.
Well, guess what? It's Scott that has the crush on you.
You lied to me.
That's key right there when he says, "You lied to me."
He must have asked him, "Is it you?" Man, false pretenses.
To be fair, though, that was 90s talk shows.
Yeah.
This is the modus operandi, as they say.
M.O.
Before we talk, take a look at, we'll show a little playback of what Scott said about you, John. Take a look at that monitor
right here?
Down there.
Oh. Well, it entails like whipped cream and champagne, stuff like that.
Donna's like, whipped cream?
Moo!
Scott was pretty open about, he's been fantasizing about you since he saw you under that car for the first time. He had an under the car fantasy and he had a hammock fantasy he's been telling us about. Did you have
Jenny
any idea
Jones
that he
coming out a little
much?
Strong?
No, I did not.
Can you tell us what your status is? Are you involved with anybody or?
No, but I am definitely a heterosexual, I guess you could say.
He'd been a huge reaction from the crowd there.
It's upstairs for me. And Scott was a guy, one night I pulled in, she was looking at her brakes, and I was looking at the brakes, too, and Scott pulls in behind me and goes, well, your car's pretty funny, because I drew this peace sign in the back of my car, and it's, you know, it says peace man on it, and then Scott says, you look like a hippie in your car, and then you get out of your car, and then he told Donna that I was a good-looking guy, and Donna told me, and I said, well, you know, it's flattering, but...
It's flattering, but you're not interested, there's no way, right?
No, I'm, you know, now
well, at least,
you
Scott, at least
be...
you got it out. Are you very disappointed?
It's interesting how he tells a happy little anecdote right there.
Right. He already says that, you know, Scott's already kind of confessed to him that he thinks he's a good-looking guy.
That's the other thing. I find it hard to believe that he was finding out about this crush for the first time here.
Yeah, I don't think it's the first time, but he had to have had that inkling. Like we said, he said, you lied to me.
Right.
So he knew, like, come on, this is a put on here. So he must have known what the outcome of the show may have become.
Well, because they all lived in the same area, right? They were neighbors, essentially.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's such an awkward situation because as a guy, you're not used to this kind of attention. Like, women all the time just think everybody's the nicest guy they've ever met in their life. But there's obviously something behind that.
Yeah.
In most instances, let's be real.
Mm-hmm.
And I had kind of a weird interaction with a comic who was like a mentor of mine in Boston. And I knew he was having a tough time and we were doing a show together. And I just wanted to lift his spirits by just being appreciative and saying, hey man, like, you know, I appreciate everything you've done for me. You hooked me up with a bunch of, bookers and stuff. And he was like, oh, come on. I wanted to fuck you. Like, pretty much like, are you stupid?
What?
And it was such a weird, awkward, we had to spend the rest of the night in the green room together. And it was just a weird feeling to have, like, that's the only reason this guy was helping me.
I feel so bad for you. In your story, you're the funniest guy who's the most fuckable.
No, not funniest. Teen fuckable, apparently. But it's just a weird thing to think about. Like, you don't think another guy is thinking that way about you when you're not thinking that way about them.
Have you been to WeHo?
Hello! I have. And these guys tried to get me in a toilet.
Oh.
During Gay Pride Week, and I was like, you having sex or doing drugs? And they're like, doing drugs. And I was like, I don't do drugs.
Sounds like a Norm MacDonald joke.
I know. I made it sound like it, too. You almost had me. Yeah, so it's a weird thing.
Right, so you can relate to Jonathan Schmitz.
Yeah, because I bought my shotgun right after, too.
God, you masshole.
Yeah. Where did the producers expect this to go? Like, they thought it was just going to be harmless fun and no one was going to get their feelings hurt or there's going to be awkward situations.
Correct.
They thought it was going to be that lighthearted?
Uh-huh.
All right.
Yeah, because, to be fair, that's how hundreds of other episodes turned out.
Yeah, but we're talking about, you don't know if this person's a complete homophobe and would freak out.
But these are the stories they did, Kyle. They were constantly towing the line between bad taste and danger and...
I was going to say, this is the years of Matthew Shepard, but Matthew Shepard wouldn't be murdered until 3 years later. So I don't think they would do this after 1998.
Let's hope not.
Yeah. So that's where the story should have ended.
Yes.
Right? Instead, the story was just beginning. Everyone gets flown home, and now they have to live in this new reality that Scott has let out of the bag. And I'm sure Jonathan's having complete anxiety about the show being aired and him becoming a laughingstock of the town, since he probably told everyone, oh, I get to go on this show. This woman is saying, you know, they're obsessed with me and they want to reveal themselves.
Wait till you see my debut.
Yeah, I have a secret admirer.
My then, network debut.
Yeah. And then you show up and it's fucking Scott and Donna sitting there.
Oh, God.
Like, Jesus Christ.
And in those days, the ratings were much bigger.
Huge.
So everyone would have seen that appearance.
Yeah, and he's only in his early 20s, so he's probably thinking his life's over as he knows it, because everyone in his town's going to see it, then everyone across the country's going to see it. He's not going to be able to walk into a Walmart without people being like, ha!
Right.
So he's just spiraling mentally. 3 days after the filming, Scott has the nerve to go over to Jonathan's house to, for lack of a better term, shoot his shot. Scott clearly didn't get the hint.
It sounds like you're blaming the victim.
No, this is my point. Scott is
the nerve.
Well, I mean,
how about the nerve on you?
He was clearly turned down on the show, okay? But yeah. this is
but in a very friendly way where they could probably still be sure. Friends.
Yeah.
Hang out.
Here's my point.
Work on cars together. I don't know.
Yeah, you know.
It's Pontiac, right? What else are you going to do?
What are you going to not throw some car oil on each other's cocks and sit on each other's laps? Pretend to drive going broom, broom. All right, time for the baby chair. Oh, baby seat, I guess.
Whatever you say, I just keep laughing for some reason. All right, so where were we?
So here's my point.
Yes, and you do have one.
Yeah. Scott's a gay man that grew up in the 60s, 70s, and 80s.
In the armpit of Michigan.
Yeah. So he's probably used to having to do some sort of coaxing with some guys into relations with himself. Mm. Because it's a time and a location that probably not everybody who was gay was out.
Are you saying it's an alternative lifestyle?
I'm saying that some guys, even if they were gay, would turn him down out of fear of being
right.
outed,
right.
even though it's something they probably might have wanted to do anyway.
Or they would have partook in intercourse.
Yeah.
And then regretted it and maybe beat him up.
Yes. When he found Jonathan either not home or not answering his door, he ended up leaving a sexually explicit note on his front door saying everything he wants them to do together.
Like what?
Like making gay sex together.
It wasn't just suggestive, from what I remember in one of those documentaries. It was very graphic, this note.
Yeah, it was very descriptive.
Right.
Lots of adjectives and verbs. And
they rhyme with the word duck, perhaps.
Yes. There was a lot going on. And clearly, Scott did not take the hint.
No,
and
because he felt something. He felt some kind of connection.
Yeah, blood in his cock.
Which could have been very real to him.
Yeah, the erections were real.
No, but also he... All right. You don't think that he possibly might have thought he was getting a vibe from Jonathan?
That he had stood a chance?
I don't know. I've heard that maybe Jonathan was closeted.
There are a few things that came out.
Okay. But not Jonathan officially.
But on this day, yeah. On this day, March 9th, 1995, 3 days after they filmed on March 6th, 1995, Jonathan comes home, finds a note, reads it, is completely disgusted, having a panic attack, being like, this guy just does not fucking get it. Detective Craig Stout quoted Schmitz as saying, at that point, I decided I was going to kill him. Well, after he read that note, and he's spiraling already.
Yep.
And he's like, this fucking guy's got to go.
That's the catalyst.
Yeah. Schmitz admitted that upon reading the note, he bought a shotgun and shells. And we're not talking about macaroni shells over here. We're talking about actual ammunition.
Yes.
For this gun, if you don't know what I mean.
We don't want our audience to be confused.
Yeah. What kind of seashells?
And Donna's going, shells, where can I get them? I'm hungry.
A bunch of gas stations? Shell gas stations? So he returned to his apartment after getting the shotgun and bullets and went to his apartment to load up. Puts everything in his car with the peace sign, mind you, and drives to Amager's home. When he gets to Scott's home, he asks him point blank if he was the person who left the note. And Scott responded with a smirk and a laugh.
Who, me?
An enraged Jonathan Schmitz then went to his car and returned to Scott's door with a shotgun, firing twice in his chest.
Ugh.
He was killed instantly.
That is a definitive action.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, he read that note and that's it.
Yeah.
Wow.
He was arrested.
Why not just threaten him?
Because then...
Don't kill him.
Yeah.
God.
Yeah, it's hard to say what his mindset was at this time. It's like...
I mean, it's not that hard. He was embarrassed.
He was embarrassed.
And selfish.
Yeah.
Selfish.
Yeah.
Like, that's the most important thing, that he was embarrassed. Get over it.
Yeah.
He didn't have to show up on the show. He knew it was going to be a surprise.
Yeah, and he had asked Scott if it was him. So he had an inkling of an idea that it could turn out that way.
Exactly. So how can you feel bad for him when he signed up for that? He didn't sign up for it, you know, it being Scott,
yeah,
necessarily, but you would really believe producers of a trash talk show that it's not going to be a humiliating experience?
Yeah.
Like, I know they're lured by the trip to Chicago and all that, but come on.
Yeah, we talked about this on Tuesday Night Live on YouTube. If any listeners that are listening on Spotify or Apple haven't seen, every Tuesday night at 7 p.m. we go live. And we were talking about how the crazy cabbie just passed away, and he had gone up against Howard Stern and sued him for tarnishing the brand of his diet pill.
Because he was fat when he showed up on it trying to hawk this diet supplement.
Yeah, but anyone and anything that was mentioned on the Howard Stern show outside of Howard was tarnished.
Right.
Like, that was the point of the show.
You know what you're stepping into for the most part.
Yeah.
On Jenny Jones and on Howard Stern.
Yeah. So after he killed Scott, Jonathan left his house and immediately called 911 to confess what he had just done.
Like Spivey.
Yeah. He was arrested and charged with first-degree murder, and this is actually where things get weird. So during the trial, Scott...
Now.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
This is when things start to get really weird, because Scott's good friend said during the trial that the night they filmed that show, on March 6, 1995, they went out and had drinks together and ended up sleeping together in their hotel in Chicago.
What?
Yes.
Sleeping together.
They had drinks and Scott said he fucked them.
Shut up.
That night. Yeah.
I did not know this.
So
they had sex.
That is never been, it's never been confirmed, but that was the testimony of Scott's friend during the trial.
Wow.
And I think that could be a little bit of saving face or allowing him to say, like, oh, he was distraught and had, you know, buyer's remorse and, like you said, had regret.
Because he had sex with him and was on the show revealing, perhaps,
yeah,
to the world.
I don't know if I believe that, though, because why would he be so confused as to who left the note on his door? Showing up being like, was that you?
Yeah, but how do we know he was confused?
Because he showed up. He admitted that he went and asked Scott if he wrote the note. Jonathan.
Oh, okay. So we'll just believe anything he says? What if he told you that the sky is off neon?
That's true. Jonathan said it. Yeah, I mean, that's a good point.
Right?
It's entirely possible he could have. We don't know. He hasn't talked about it publicly or, I mean, who knows, privately.
You know that too.
Publicly or privately. Yeah, I know everything.
Yeah, you seem to know a lot.
So this invoked a controversial defense during this trial. His defense had told the jury that he was suffering from bipolar disorder and Graves' disease.
He's definitely bi something.
Hello. And was forced to commit homicide due to mental illness and public humiliation. And they informed the court that they were invoking the gay panic defense.
Right.
Which is a legal defense strategy.
Did that ever work?
Let's see.
I know that Dan White, is he the guy that killed Milk? He said that he had eaten a Twinkie. And so his sugar
that
levels
was a little
were
gay?
Off. Yeah, and that's why he killed Harvey Milk.
Wow. It's not a good day for Twinkie stock.
No. They for real call it the Twinkie defense.
It's or Twink thing. Stock.
Oh, boy.
Okay, gay panic defense. This is from Wikipedia. The gay panic defense, or homosexual advance defense, is a strategy of legal defense which refers to a situation in which a heterosexual individual charged with a violent crime against a homosexual or bisexual or pansexual.
Or trisexual, as Andy Dick likes to say.
Call me trisexual because I'll try anything. Claims that they lost control and reacted violently because of unwanted sexual advances that were made upon them. A defendant will use available legal defenses against assault and murder with the aim of seeking an acquittal, a mitigated sentence, or a conviction of a lesser offense.
I hope this never worked.
A defendant may allege to have found sexual advances so offensive or frightening that they were provoked into reacting, were acting in self-defense, of diminished capacity, or were temporarily insane.
Wow.
What do you think about that?
That's a mouthful.
There's a lot of mouthful in here.
Okay.
Homosexual panic disorder. Edward J. Kempf, a psychiatrist, coined the term homosexual panic in 1920 and identified it as a condition of, quote, panic due to the pressure of uncontrollable perverse sexual cravings.
Okay.
And classified it as an acute pernicious dissociative disorder, meaning that it involved a disruption in typical perception and memory functions. Okay.
Yeah.
Wow.
A lot going on in the 20s.
It was in the
wearing the money, doing the Charleston.
It's not sucking cocks.
Gay panic.
Yeah, it was in the DSM-1 and does not appear in any subsequent editions of the DSM.
Oh, wow.
Okay, so yeah, that's the gay panic defense related to homosexual panic disorder. Like I said, it's never been confirmed if the friend of Scott was telling the truth during the trial that they had sexual encounters the night of the Jenny Jones taping on March 6th.
What about Donna? Couldn't she corroborate this story?
She could, but she was too busy eating.
Okay. Please. We're better than this.
Cover your mouth. Mr. Jonathan Schmitz was found guilty of murder and sentenced to 25 to 50 years in prison. The family of Scott Amador sued the Jenny Jones Show plus more. It was ruled that the Jenny Jones Show and company pay the family nearly $27 million in damages over how they treated the casting, knowing it would cause conflict.
Wow. Let's go.
Pow, right in the kisser.
I'm glad the family got some money for this because, well.
Oh, did you think that's where it all ended?
You know.
No, this is powerful network studios here that we're talking about. They took it all the way up to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court then overturned the court's decision.
What?
Claiming there was no way for the show to know that Jonathan would end up murdering Scott, so they never saw a dime.
Oh, my God.
Newest update. August of 2017, a parole board found that they would indeed release Jonathan from prison after serving 22 years behind bars. He had admitted to no longer being homophobic and that he was not a danger to anyone else or the public.
Why was he no longer homophobic?
Because he probably had some of that prison justice, if you know what I mean. Yeah, who knows? I mean, I think the parole board did say that they wanted to hear him and how much he's changed. So even if it was complete bullshit, like, oh, I'm not homophobic anymore. Maybe he was never homophobic.
They're like, prove it. We're going to play gay chicken.
Yeah. It might not have been about being homophobic. It could have been about how this person would not stop their relentless pursuit. And, you know, everyone was going to make a mockery of him. And it was more of a panic about his you know, perceived character.
Okay, let me hear the other side now, Kyle.
Or he could have been freaking out because the guy was gay and he was disgusted by it.
Maybe it was just a funny, friendly guy.
Yeah. Well, as far as we know, he has stayed out of trouble. It's been 7 years and he's out there living his life.
He hasn't killed any more people.
No.
He hasn't appeared on any talk shows.
No, he's probably not a fan of surprises, so yeah, he probably just.
You don't think they did a surprise party for his 50th?
Surprise!
Ah! He pulls out a shotgun.
Latest news from 6 days ago.
6 days.
Former talk show host Jenny Jones sells $8 million Beverly Hills mansion.
Wow, $8 million.
So she just cashed in.
Wow.
Yeah.
She made a ton of money from that show. It was on for a long time.
Yeah.
Over 10 years.
Yep.
I think it ended in 2003. That's the other part.
12 years.
People might not realize. The show continued after this.
Oh, yeah.
It was the biggest story at that time. I remember when I was a kid, it was a really disturbing. I must have seen a Dateline or something on it.
Yeah, Jones.
Because I watched all those shows as a kid.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's how I would spend my summers.
Yeah,
we would just watch talk shows all day. I did Sally. I did Jenny Jones. And she used to have these really dumb segments. Do you remember this? Where she would have these characters come on that were like people in costumes, and sometimes they would be like miniature.
What?
Yeah, I'm not even making this up. She would have these fantastical elements to the talk show, probably as a result of this, where it was so light and fluffy that
wow,
it wasn't even 1% controversial.
That's crazy. I don't remember that. We're going to have to delve into that.
Yeah, like she'd be like, hey, Lenny the cowboy, what do you have to say? And then there would be like a miniature cowboy on someone's shoulder like, hey, Jenny, yeehaw.
What?
Yeah.
It's starting to sound more familiar.
It was really weird.
We're going to have to go back and do a deep dive on this.
Does anyone out there remember these moments?
Yeah, write us an email at deathandentertainment@gmail.com. Yeah,
Jenny Jones show got weird.
Wow. Yeah. Weirder than this. It is also another body under the Warner Brothers emblem.
Ugh.
Because Jenny Jones was backed by the old WB.
Wow. And they know something about not taking accountability for deaths.
Yeah. Who, of course, was involved in the Twilight Zone massacre.
Yeah.
Here in Santa Clarita.
Or accident, as some want it to be called.
Yeah. Either way, no bueno.
No.
But yeah, RIP to Scott Amajur.
I think it's time for
final thoughts.
I mean, as far as story one goes, I think you planted a seed in my head that I didn't really think about. The fact that he could have shot himself in the thigh and then killed his wife. That to me is terrifying.
But then you said that because of the femoral artery, that could be very dangerous to be shot in the thigh.
Yes, but not everybody really knows that or thinks that way. So if that's the case, pretty terrifying. If not, tragic accident that should have never happened with people tussling over a gun. That is just... Don't have loaded guns in the house that accessible when you're that angry.
And there's nothing more pitiful than a toxic relationship.
Yeah. Yeah.
As a witness, as a participant.
Yeah, it's overall draining for everybody. And never really ends well if you don't just cut it off. Story one, tragic. Rest in peace to Patricia Spivey. That is just not the best way to go.
And Renard Spivey is either a psychopath or a nice guy that got caught up in a bad situation.
Yeah.
Or not a nice guy and got caught up in a bad situation.
Yeah, who knows? But found not guilty. He's out there living his life. And just like Jonathan Schmitz is now.
Yeah. I have a question. Why wasn't Jonathan Schmitz bothered by the SNL parody commercial Schmitz Gay?
Oh.
If he's so concerned. Why didn't he sue SNL?
Wait, what year was that? That was probably
93, I want to say.
91. So he's probably already getting shit.
Yeah.
Wow.
That was a part of the pop culture. Schmitz Gay.
That is an interesting turn of events here, that he was probably already getting shit.
Yeah.
So already on guard to not want to be known as gay. And then all of a sudden this happens.
My final thought on the matter is that he knew what he was getting into by going on live television. I don't buy that he was naive about it because everybody was watching those shows then.
He was 24 and Scott was almost a decade older than him. So to me...
Well, you didn't say that.
A little bit more naive, and Scott could have been really...
At 24.
Been overbearing. Yeah, of course. I was dumb until... I'm still dumb.
I was wondering where that was going to go. 24, you're acting like he was a little kid.
He was but a child.
Well, we know what your final thought is on the Jenny Jones murder.
Horrific situation.
Yeah.
Extremely avoidable.
Yes. And you don't know all the details.
Yeah, we don't. We don't know if he had sex with them, and that's why he had some sort of remorse about it and freaked out. We don't know.
And let's take that off the table.
He's out of prison, so we could ask him personally.
Right. Well, if he heard this podcast, he might actually come and talk to us. Because he's got a big supporter.
Oh, big supporter, yeah.
I just think that it was all overblown.
Hello!
I don't know.
Sounds like Scott wasn't blown enough.
Oh, my God.
He wanted more.
It did not warrant his life ending.
No, of course.
I don't care how embarrassed Jonathan Schmidt's gay is.
Yeah.
It's like, he knew what he was getting into. And yes, it's unfortunate. And that's not great behavior on Scott's part to keep egging him on. But we really don't know all the details.
Yeah.
So there's multiple people that say differing things about the situation.
Right.
So, especially if they were drinking together after the show and partying in the hotel room.
Yeah.
That's a polite word for it.
Having a romp.
A romp roast.
We don't know.
According to Donna.
Oh, God. Leave Donna alone.
That's the new hashtag. Leave Donna alone.
Yeah. Yeah, tragic. Two tragic events that could have been completely avoided and ended in consequences that will last forever.
I think we can meet in the middle, though, right? Yeah. Scott did not deserve this.
No, definitely not.
And that is a very sickening byproduct of a homophobic culture, unfortunately.
Yeah.
Which we all remember full and well from the 1990s.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
Either way, like you just said, tragic situation.
Yeah. R.I.P. to Scott and Patricia.
But what do you think?
Yeah, send us your thoughts. Was he a complete, out-of-control, homophobic maniac? Was Mr. Spivey a roid-raged-out lunatic looking for blood? You be the judge.
Do you hear that?
You've got mail.
Oh, my God, we've got mail. Can you believe it?
Goody, goody gumdrops.
We got one on the Aaron Carter episode with Ben Kissel. Jake Saban said, Ben, missed you, man. Last podcast is so lame without you. We don't know about that, but we did appreciate him having him on. And a lot of people did send us messages saying we should have Ben on again. Ben is welcome anytime.
Yeah, we had a good time. And yeah, we got a lot of great responses. And on Instagram, people were writing us saying they came to hear Ben Kissel and stayed for us.
Exactly.
Which is very flattering.
Yes.
We're not worthy.
DMB fan, Dave Matthews Band fan, said that they just found our channel and really enjoy it so far. You definitely earned my subscription. I feel like I'm going to be here a while. You've covered a lot of great subjects. Keep up the good work.
Thank you.
That is a great review slash just comment. Thank you so much.
Yeah, we love hearing your feedback.
Yeah.
We look forward to it.
Yeah. If anybody's listening on Spotify or Apple, hit pause right now and just give us a 5-star review. Come on. Will it kill you? No, it wouldn't.
And would it kill you to go to our Patreon, patreon.com/deathandentertainment, where currently you can find our latest episode, a complete breakdown, a deep dive into the infamous Larry King interview with Brittany Murphy's mom and Simon Konjac.
An hour and 45 minutes of pure joy. And awkwardness.
It's so awkward. At one point, Simon Konjac says that he didn't want to do an autopsy because his wife had, what was it, milky thin
curves in all the right places.
Yeah.
And milk-like skin. And then just cut her up. Yeah, he just didn't want to get caught showing all the actual drugs she had coursing through her veins that he gave her. So
they were hiding a lot of things.
A lot of things. And you know what? We're not hiding the actual content. You just got to go pay $5 to see it, okay?
And there are a ton of other episodes there too.
We've got like 100 hours worth of stuff over there. It's worth $5 a month.
Let's it really is. And you help us keep the lights on.
Yes, exactly. I got a baby on the way, okay?
Yeah. And I need to get Taco Bell.
Yeah. So, yes, do all those things. Please help us out and come back and listen next week. And until next week,
don't go dying on us.
Bye-bye.
You have just heard
a true Hollywood murder mystery.
I have never seen anything like this before.
The movies, Broadway, music, television, all of it.
A place that manufactures
nightmares.
Okay, everybody, that's a wrap.
Good night. Please drive home carefully and come back again soon.